From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, finding basic truths about movement and the human body, we talk with one of the most acclaimed choreographers of our time, Twyla Tharp. Also today, the Red Cross in Somalia. We'll check back with Anne Stingle of the Red Cross, who just returned from Somalia. We first spoke with her 3 weeks ago, just before she left for Africa. And rock critic Ken Tucker tells us about rock's latest unlikely rocker. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The United States is reportedly moving an aircraft carrier into the Persian Gulf a day after U.S. forces shot down an Iraqi jet. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
According to the Associated Press, Pentagon officials say they're dispatching the carrier Kitty Hawk to the Gulf. The ship had been stationed there previously until it was sent to the waters off Somalia to help with the U.S. military relief effort in the East African nation. The officials say the move is in response to yesterday's downing of an Iraqi jet that had entered a UN-imposed no-fly zone over southern Iraq. President Bush and President-elect Clinton both reacted to the incident as though it were an intentional provocation by Saddam Hussein. Both men said the Iraqi leader was trying to test U.S. resolve in enforcing United Nations sanctions against Iraq, and both called Saddam Hussein's move a mistake. Some analysts believe Iraq was trying to determine whether the UN was preoccupied by its mission in Somalia and the growing crisis in the former Yugoslavia. I'm Andy Bowers in Washington.
The Israeli army said today that 10 of the 415 Palestinians expelled to Lebanon can return home. An army statement said the 10 were found to have been mistakenly expelled from the occupied territories. It said they could return home but would have to face trial in Israel. The statement said there was evidence of what it called serious activities against some of those expelled. It said that if they're convicted, they can expect periods of imprisonment that are longer than the exile. The Israeli expulsion orders limited the exile to 2 years. A United Nations envoy, James Jonah, has had talks with the Palestinian leaders in Jerusalem about the Palestinians expelled to southern Lebanon. The Palestinian leaders repeated that Israel must abide by the UN resolution calling for all those expelled to be allowed home. The BBC's Alex Brody reports.
The UN envoy, Mr. Jonah, was told bluntly by the Israelis that they will not comply with the UN resolution which demands they take the exiles back. So when he went to see the Palestinians, they demanded that the UN force the Israelis to comply, instead of, as spokeswoman Hanan Ashrawi put it, letting them get away with it as usual. There's still deadlock over supplies to the exiles, with both Israel and Lebanon refusing to let aid pass for fear of acknowledging responsibility for the exiles. But according to sources in the Prime Minister's office, Israel has not turned down a suggestion from Mr. Jonah that aid could be supplied from each side simultaneously. What was to have been the final part of his mission, a visit to the exiles' camp, is now in jeopardy. The Lebanese have followed Israel in refusing to allow him access through their lines to the camp.
Alex Brody reporting from Jerusalem. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 7 points to close at 3,333. Declines led advances by a slight margin in moderate trading. This is NPR. A state grand jury has indicted Alabama Governor Guy Hunt. The exact charges were not immediately disclosed, but the grand jury has been investigating Hunt's finances for months. Hunt reported to the county jail in Montgomery, Alabama today, denouncing the charges as outrageous lies. Hunt is a preacher in the Primitive Baptist Church, and he was accused of using state airplanes to travel on preaching trips for which he received nearly $10,000 in offerings. The grand jury investigation was later expanded to cover other financial matters involving Hunt and his administration. A small school district in northern Michigan is planning on ending the school year early because it's running out of money. Doug Massey of member station WKAR reports.
Kalkaska Public Schools plan to close 2 months early this year as a $1.5 million budget shortfall looms. Graduation has been moved up from May 29th to March 27th. The early shutdown would be a first in Michigan, but the state says it's not going to let that happen. The Department of Education is willing to go to court or take over the 2,300 student district and run it in receivership. Kalkaska officials say the choice is between providing a quality education or a sophisticated babysitting service. Kalkaska officials aren't invited to a meeting at the state capitol in Lansing next week to discuss the problem. For National Public Radio, I'm Doug Massey in East Lansing, Michigan.
Tennessee Governor Ned McWhorter has named a top aide to fill the Senate seat that's being vacated by Vice President-elect Al Gore. The seat will go to Harlan Matthews, the governor's deputy, until the 1994 general election. Gore's seat actually had 4 years to run, but the seat will be up for election in 1994 and again in 1996 to put the election back on its normal 6-year cycle. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Twyla Tharp was once described as the most remarkable departure in American dance since Isadora Duncan rejected ballet shoes. Dance critic Laura Shapiro said of Tharp's choreography, "It's not ballet, it's not what we think of as modern dance either. No agony, no hard edges, no pristine leotards. This movement is made up of shrugs and shudders, quick slides and lightning-fast changes of direction." Twyla Tharp has created a dance vocabulary based on ordinary movement, and she's choreographed dances to music by Fats Waller, Jelly Roll Morton, The Beach Boys, and David Byrne. Some of her best-known dances were created for Mikhail Baryshnikov. When he was director of the American Ballet Theater, she joined him as artistic associate. Now they're on tour together, performing her dances. Tharp has written an autobiography named after one of her dances for Baryshnikov, Push Comes to Shove. In the book, Tharp writes that as a child, she worked in the drive-in theater that her parents ran in California. She told me what that was like.
Well, first of all, it was against the child labor laws, so that whenever any of those folks would come, having had word that my mother had an 8-year-old working in the snack bar, I would be hidden in a back room. So I got, from the very beginning, the idea that something pretty exciting and illegal was going on here. That was the first aspect of it. Secondarily, it happened at nighttime, so night, which is illicit to most children after 10 or 11, became a time when I had to kind of fight to stay awake because we were still doing business. And third of all, it was, in a way, very insular because it kept me away from children my own age and from participating in those kinds of games. On the other hand, it put me in a position to watch. From an early age, I had the idea that one of the most potent places to be was an outside objective viewer, whether it was an audience watching a movie or whether it was a person, as I say in the book, who has to calculate what the audience thinks so that you get in behind the snack bar before you have a rush. So I think more than children ordinarily do, I developed a sense of myself as an objective, judgmental force rather than an emotional participating one.
Well, you not only got to watch the movie and got to watch the audience, you also got to watch the movie watching the audience. You got to watch the movie not watching the audience and making love in their cars. What was it like for you as an 8-year-old to see all this stuff happening?
Well, I'm not sure that I actually, when I was 8, was roaming the ramps, but I certainly was by the time I was 10 or 11 or 12. It just became, you know, a regular way of life. I suppose it's the same. I mean, this is being very extreme, but I suppose it's the same as children who are around, other sorts of illicit sexual activities as business. It becomes just, you know, matter of course.
Let me quote something you write in your book. You say, "The art of 50s movies was sustaining forever the moment before sex. They were a great big come-on, arousing without satisfying. I sensed early this perpetually suspended condition could be translated into art." Do you feel that you've translated that into your dance?
On occasion. I don't think this is a negative thing. I think it's really quite an extraordinary thing. It's a source of great energy, and energy is one of the largest components of my trade, how to manage it, how to generate it, how to control it, how to enlarge it, how to bring it down. It's called pacing. And I think that this sense that I acquired of, you know, it's manipulation, and it's one of the tools in any director's craft bag, and that being having it brought to such a clear, literal, black and white, two-dimensional form with the movies and with the ratings at the time made it a very interesting way of understanding about sublimation and code, because really that's what it was. It was talking language of a sort in code, and that's what art is. It's a code of sorts.
Let's talk about your dancing lessons. When you were very young, you started at the Vera Lynn School of Dance. You learned tap dancing there. Then you went on to study with a French ballet teacher. What were your childhood impressions of each, you know, of tap and of ballet?
Well, I think the biggest differentiation was not so much in the styles of dance themselves, because to me, again, it was all about energy, but in the ways in which they were presented. The Vera Lynn School of the Dance had little recitals, and we put on reviews, and, you know, we did quick changes backstage, and we went from toe shoes to tap shoes to numbers with ropes to numbers with hula skirts, and it was all about entertaining an audience. And then when I entered the more classical worlds of the dancing, it became less about connecting with the audience and more about presenting something that an audience could applaud only from a distance, not connect to so immediately. After all, we all kind of can connect with a hoofer, but those ethereal beings in pointe shoes are rather more difficult to become, excepting for 5 and 6 year old girls.
Did you feel that you fit into ballet, and was there a point in your life when that was what you really wanted to do?
I never fit into the ballet. I never felt that I did, and it was never something that I really thought I would be doing.
Why did you know early on that ballet wasn't for you?
Because it was a lie.
Ballet was a lie?
In the sense that its technique was very valuable and very exciting from the waist down, but from the torso up, the rules were artificial. There was not an engineering necessity. It was the choices were made by style, which to me was a lie. Engineering was the truth. If the body had to work that way and it was the only way that made sense, then I understood it. But if it was an option, then whose determination was it that was making the choices?
So you felt you were fitting yourself into some predetermined style that didn't make
which
any sense?
Which I never liked to do.
Mm-hmm. Now, you studied with Martha Graham for a while.
Only a year, a very, very, very brief time.
In your book, you write that she often required dancers to play roles, and you couldn't imagine yourself doing being anything except who you really were. What were the problems that caused for you with Martha Graham?
Well, only that while I loved working in the technique and I had the highest regard for her and the company, I didn't understand the acting that was the basis of her art. So again, to me, as with the ballet, her medium was a lie for me, even though it was clearly a complete commitment and an absolute truth for her and the people that worked with her.
Now, you've talked about other forms of dance feeling like a lie to you. How did you start to find your own sense of truth in dance?
By trying to get back to fundamentals that I could not negate in any way, and without which one could not move. So, I mean, taken very literally, I could sometimes, as I did in the early years, sit hours in a studio, not moving at all, unless I felt I had no option but to try such and such and so and so. Now, I must say that these odd 20-so years later, I wonder at such stubbornness. But on the other hand, now when I go in to a studio and I have a facility because of the number of years and the number of hours that I've put into these empty spaces, I sometimes have to question the directions that I take and say, is this inevitable? And that really was the first question that I set out to ask. Is this step that I take, and will it be with the right or the left foot? Which direction is it going to go in? And does it absolutely have to be that way, and under what conditions does it absolutely have to be that way, so that there would be no question, and it would hopefully, therefore, have what at that time I didn't know I was really trying to deal with, but comes down to the issue of universality. Would it be something that could be common to many of us?
When you were trying to find the inevitable movements and the basic movements, did you come up with movements that were very much like normal movements, you know, like walking or jumping or, you know, just the kind of movements, like dance versions of movements that everybody does in the course of an ordinary day?
Yes, I think I came up with probably what are some pretty stupid things, if you want to know the truth. I also think that they were probably pretty limited, and I think that, I mean, I know that they were very limited, and that it was a little bit like a person learning to speak who stutters, and that the words are aborted, and that nothing has a follow-through and is very choppy. It was, I was fighting so hard against allowing for the possibilities of movement that anything that worked its way out really had to work very hard to get out. Movement was very tentative, and yes, certainly in the beginning, it was often aligned to what we call the, you know, the mundane movements, the walking, the running, the skipping, and that sometimes, because at the same time as I was working in a studio saying, where do we begin here? I would also still be studying particularly the ballet. Whenever I would feel anything from the ballet vocabulary start to enter into the dancing, I'd say, uh-oh, hold on, this feels like it's a glissade, get that out of there. I wanted nothing that already had a recognizable name to it. So if it came to running or skipping or hopping, I somehow had to trick myself into believing I had invented that. Now, don't ask me how, but for a few years, I really allowed myself that amount of liberty, and then I got on with it.
When you feel a ballet gesture creeping into your work, do you feel as totally rejecting of it now as you did when you were younger?
Well, it depends who the dancer is and what the dance is. If it's intended as a ballet, for ballet dancers, I'm rather grateful, if the truth be told. Do you know what I mean?
Right. Okay.
But there are still moments where I'll say to myself, oh, ballet, yucky. Or I'll say, this is not American. Or I'll say, this is not fundamental to human movement. Or I'll say, this is elitist. Or I'll say, that's pretty excellent. Let's use it anyway. Or I'll say, sometimes it's like I look at it like figure skaters. It's elaborate. It's Baroque. It's beside the point, and it's wonderful.
Right. Okay. During your early years as a choreographer, you were married, and your husband was an artist, something of an avant-gardist. From reading your book, it sounds like he taught you a lot, but on the other hand, you felt at some point that he had a set of rules that one had to maintain to be a serious artist or a true avant-gardist, and that started to feel really cramping to you after a while. What were those restrictions that you felt his kind of philosophy was placing on you?
I'm not sure that I can be absolutely specific about it. I will try. At the time, the movement was minimalist art, and in the beginning, the work that I did certainly fit into that category because my inclination was to try and find the basis of movement. So I was perfectly happy to start with these, as I call them, rudimentary building blocks, the ABCs. But as I worked more and more and more and tried to include more and more and more and make it relevant and expand the work that I did from the inside out, it began to feel as though I was betraying the minimalist ethos. And also, at the time, it was very much in the air that, to use an expression of the time, that that artists were, in a way, political, and that their art made a statement. And I found myself less and less interested in that. I simply wanted to make the art, and that began to feel as though it was an issue. And then, of course, there is the business of art for the sake of art, and the purists, of whom Clifford Still was the most extreme example, completely leaving the art world and, you know, moving as far north as he could get. And I, on the other hand, being in a live art form and also having been trained as a child to take into account the audience, found this somewhat unnatural and became more and more interested in what an audience thought, to use performances and the proscenium stage as a laboratory for researching what went through an audience's mind and where I did and did not see parallel with them. And this, too, seemed out of place in the 60s avant-garde.
My guest is choreographer Twyla Tharp, and she's written a new autobiography called Push Comes to Shove. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Choreographer Twyla Tharp is my guest, and she's written a new autobiography. You got pregnant before you were married, and when you were pregnant that first time, you had an abortion. You didn't feel ready to have a child. What were your concerns about becoming a mother then, or being pregnant then?
Well, I think that the first question is the appropriate one, and would be the same one that I think any woman would ask today. What does it mean to be a mother? And I did not feel at that time that I could be responsible to the degree that I would believe necessary and also continue to work. And I did not feel that the time was right for me to stop working and that the two simply could not be simultaneously accommodated.
When you did get pregnant and decide to have the baby, were you concerned at all about how the pregnancy, you know, how carrying a child would affect your dancer's body?
I was, but I decided, and I think it was a very good decision, that I would not let this divide my life, and that I would include the baby in the dancing. So I continued to work right up until I went into the hospital, but each day would be a different way of working because my body was different. And I have trained myself to ask myself to grow up along with my body growing up, and that was a very valuable period of time. I mean, to be literal about it, for example, the way in which the body's proportions shift forces your center of gravity to a totally different place. Continuing to work during that period, I had the rare opportunity to experience this and to relish it, so that instead of demanding that my body do things that it did when it was not pregnant, not carrying a child, I really tried to investigate as much as I could the things that were unique to it at the moment.
Is there anything that you still use that you learned then? Any kinds of gestures that came out of that?
I think a sense of weight that came out of that I will always have. There is some videotape. I managed to get a video camera during the course of that year and recorded about 22 half-hour tapes. One can clearly see a shift in how weight is employed, and it's a sensation that I remembered long after the fact, still do.
After the birth of your son, Jesse, you say that you felt your work needed to start reflecting the male presence. You had choreographed for women before that. What was different about choreographing for men?
Well, I think that clearly men and women are very different beings from the point of view of what they can accommodate physically. Men traditionally have been faster, stronger. That they occupy an arena which makes, in most sports, mixed doubles very uncomfortable. Competition happens best amongst men and women in separate categories, basically speaking here. And as a choreographer beginning, I wanted to investigate the possibilities of the female. Also, as I say in the book, I didn't want men intimidating us with these possibilities of more power and more speed. I wanted us to feel that we were working at an absolute edge, and therefore we set about to do so for 5 years until we came to a point where we felt we knew ourselves and our potentials fairly well, and then we could see what the male imperative might be here. And as I write in the book, the mix of men and women I thought would probably have a big impact on what our subject matter was, which was also true. Recently, in order to address this issue of the difference between the male and female physical potential, I've started doing a lot of weight training. Not that I think I'm ever going to challenge any of the male, you know, power bench or squat records, but I have found that believing that I'm pushing my body to my own max affects very differently how I can relate to men. And I think that was the point of our early experiment, was to believe that we had gone as far as we could, not with somebody looking over our shoulders who perhaps could get a little higher or go a little faster.
Tell me a little bit more about how working out with weights has kind of changed your sense of what male dancers can do.
Well, no, it hasn't since changed my sense of what male dancers can do, because most men who dance don't do weights. What it has provided me with is an upper body strength that allows me to do a very different kind of partnering than most women can accommodate. And it allows a different sense of the total body conditioning and a different kind of stamina than most women have. I mean, I work in gyms where there are serious weight trainers. I mean, my trainer does 550 pounds on the bench, and, you know, it's not unusual for somebody to do 800 pounds squatting. This is a lot of weight. They do over a ton on the leg press. I mean, this is, like, real.
As you get older, and you're, what, in your early 50s now?
All impossible, both of the above, yes.
Yeah. So are you changing the movements that you're doing yourself?
Certainly not. I'm working harder. Sure. I mean, excuse me, but, you know, it's just like the pregnancy. Growing older means the body is changing. It does not mean the body is deteriorating. To me, it means it's altering. I insist upon looking at it that way and realizing that there are new lessons to be learned every day from a body that's different.
How much are you dancing now?
I work, usually I do an hour of gym work, weight work, then I will do a bar and sort of improvisational work for another hour, and then the performances, which are, you know, an hour of dancing or so.
You write in your book that your energy used to come from competition, victimization, seduction, and fantasy. Where does it come from now?
Well, those all sound like they're good, don't they? let's see. Where does it come from now? It comes from a sense of having tried a lot of things, knowing that it's knowing the difference between caffeine energy and the energy that comes from a body profoundly rested and prepared. Very different things.
Is there any part of your body that's in distress now?
That's an unfair question. I think that anybody who works always has a portion of their body in disrepair, and that is an absolute necessity.
Okay.
I'm teasing you.
All right.
I wish that I could see you, because sometimes I hope my tone of voice is giving you a certain set in the mouth, which you would know means that this is supposed to be funny. No, I'm not in any particular pain, any more than any dancer ever is. Every dancer always has something that is kvetching.
Right. Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Twyla Tharp's new autobiography is Push Comes to Shove. She's touring with Mikhail Baryshnikov and will be performing in Fort Lauderdale, Miami Beach, West Palm Beach, Indianapolis, and Pittsburgh in early January. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Jerry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, Red Cross feeding centers after the arrival of troops. We talk with the Red Cross's Anne Stingel. She just returned from Somalia. She was also there last May. She'll tell us how things have changed. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Can You Fly, the new album by rock's latest nerd, Freddie Johnston. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Officials in Israel have announced that 10 of the more than 400 Palestinians exiled recently to southern Lebanon can now return to Israel. The army says the 10 were exiled by mistake. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
The announcement was the first sign of any softening in the Israeli position since the 415 Palestinians were expelled 12 days ago. An army statement said that a check carried out by the army showed that 10 of the men had security information which indicated hostile activity against them, but there was no legal decision to expel them. The statement said the men could return, but they will have to face trial in Israel. The announcement came after reports in the Israeli press that some of the men had been expelled by mistake. A senior security official told NPR that as many as 40 Palestinians may have been expelled in error. It was not clear if Israel is continuing to investigate further cases. It was also unknown when the men would return to Israel. The announcement came at the end of a two-day visit by UN Special Envoy James Jonah to Israel. He leaves tomorrow for Beirut. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
U.S. officials have given another warning about violations of no-fly zones in Iraq. The State Department spokesman says when two Iraqi planes flew into a no-fly zone yesterday, it was part of a challenge by Baghdad to the U.S. and the U.N. American warplanes shot down one of the Iraqi planes. The zone was set up as protection for rebel forces opposed to Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein. The State Department says that allied forces are now on alert and ready to respond as necessary. In Cairo, Simon Ingram of the BBC reports on official Iraqi media reaction to yesterday's downing of the Iraqi plane.
Outrage is the stock-in-trade of Baghdad's state-controlled newspapers on such occasions, and today was no exception. The publication of the ruling Ba'ath Party, Al-Thawra, said the destruction of the Iraqi jet had been an act of insolent aggression and warned that popular indignation would be unleashed in the face of President Bush. Al-Jumhuriyah went somewhat further, declaring that Mr. Bush, who, as it put it, would shortly be dumped in the dustbin of history, seemed determined to cram the remaining weeks of his administration with criminal acts. Elsewhere in the region, reaction has so far been muted. Many Arab governments were worried from the start that the air exclusion zone would lead to the breakup of Iraq, and the shooting down of the plane has served to remind them of this concern.
Simon Ingram of the BBC reporting from Cairo. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 7 points to close at 3,333.26 on volume of some 144 million shares. Trading was moderate. This is NPR News. Snow and freezing rain caused travel problems in eastern and western parts of the nation this morning. In the west, blowing snow clogged major highways in Washington State, and ice closed a highway in northern Arizona. In Pennsylvania, transportation officials said that salt trucks had trouble getting through because of numerous accidents and traffic jams caused by icy roads. In North and South Carolina, thousands of homes were left without electricity because of downed power lines. In Nashville, the governor of Tennessee has announced his choice to fill the Senate seat now held by Vice President-elect Al Gore. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
Democratic Governor Ned McWhorter selected his own deputy, Harlan Matthews, to take over for Gore when the new vice president resigns his seat on January 2nd. The seat will be contested in a special election in 1994, but the winner will only serve out the remainder of Gore's term, which expires in 1996. Another election for a full 6-year term will then be held. Throughout his selection process, Governor McWhorter said he was making up two lists of candidates, one of people who wanted the Senate job and intended to seek re-election, and another of so-called caretakers, people meant to occupy the seat until the special election. He said today Harlan Matthews will be such a caretaker, free from the political concerns that go with running for office. The 65-year-old Matthews is a familiar fixture in Tennessee politics. He has worked in top state government jobs off and on since 1950. He's expected to support the new administration strongly. I'm Andy Bowers in Washington.
In Little Rock, President-elect Bill Clinton postponed a trip to Hilton Head, South Carolina for a day. A spokesman says it's to give Clinton a chance to catch up on his paperwork before leaving tomorrow for a private weekend featuring a series of seminars on a wide range of topics. For the last several years, the Clintons have taken part in the New Year's weekend gathering. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. My guest Ann Stingle just returned from 7 days in Somalia, touring Red Cross feeding centers. Stingle is a spokesperson for the American Red Cross. The International Red Cross is the leading aid agency in Somalia. We spoke with Stingle just before she left for Somalia and asked her to check back with us when she returned home. Things had changed since her previous trip to Somalia last May. This is one of the images that now haunts her.
I was standing in the middle of a feeding center in Baidoa, and I remembered that one of the images that struck me most when I was in Somalia before was the image of women trying to nurse their children, doing it out of sheer instinct, even though they were so hungry themselves they had nothing left to give, and being very touched by that image. And I was standing in the middle of a feeding center in Baidoa, and I was looking, I had just stopped for a minute and was looking around saying, something's missing here, something's not right. And then I noticed that it was that image I wasn't seeing. There were no nursing mothers. And suddenly it hit me like a thunderbolt. There are no children in Baidoa. It was as if a Pied Piper had come in and taken them all away. Under the age of 4 to 5, there are no small children in Baidoa. And they became very, very noticeable and conspicuous in their absence once you realize that they were gone. It was something I knew intellectually, but until I faced a town that has no children, no small children, it was just very, very powerful for me. You do see older children, 4 and 5 and older. But of the younger ones, they're simply not there. They're dead.
What are some of the other images that really stay with you?
Once we went into a field hospital where the ICRC had sent in a surgical team. And there had been some, there was a feeding center that the night before, and this is an emergency feeding center where they were taking care of the severely malnourished, you know, the skeletal emaciated people. And some looters had gone into the feeding center and had shot it up for just a few bags of grain and left 5 of these people who were starving to death in the first place, had shot them. And they were laying there, and you know it's just tragedy upon tragedy. You know how can this happen to someone who's dying of starvation to begin with?
Now I believe you arrived in Somalia at just about the time that the troops were starting to leave Mogadishu for other parts of Somalia. Did you see things gradually change as you were there?
It takes a while for food and nutritional status of people to change. That just is a matter of time. You could see a visible difference in security. One of the things that became a rather predictable phenomenon was that when word went out that the military would be moving into an area, that area would become very unstable and very insecure because the gunmen that were there would become really agitated and seeing the end of their own power, at least in that particular place, and move on. But for a time being, it would become, that particular town would become very unstable.
It was recently announced that the Green Line has been dismantled, and that kind of separated the north and the south of Somalia, each part controlled by a different warlord. But now that area is supposed to be just totally in rubble. Can you describe what it was like to cross the Green Line, which still existed when you were in Somalia?
Mogadishu itself is in rubble. Just trying to get around Mogadishu, how do you go find a compound where someone is staying? Because there are no landmarks. You can't go use any building as a landmark because it's just in such rubble. There are no street signs, nothing. I mean, the whole city is just destroyed. And so certainly along the Green Line, it was that way as well. Where we crossed was not in the dead center of town, but it was a place that people were quite agitated. Our drivers were very nervous about being there, and we had to wait. You couldn't take your vehicle across the Green Line. You had to get out of your vehicle and get into another one on the other side. And the drivers that had taken us to the Green Line and had to wait for the other one to pick us up were starting to get very, very nervous sitting there for a while. I guess I was uninformed enough not to know that I should have been nervous. But, in retrospect, I can see that they were very, very upset at having to be there waiting for the other car.
So the last time you were there, you had security. What the policy of the Red Cross, I know, for food shipments is not to use armed security. What's the policy for people who are traveling like yourself?
Well, even the ICRC was forced in the time of this terrible period that Somalia is coming out of. They had to have a security team with their delegates wherever they went. At least we had one with us, and perhaps it was me being someone other than ICRC, but there was usually a technical team. They had had several delegates shot, so it became necessary. Now, they would not allow them in the same car as whatever vehicle it was that had the Red Cross emblem could not have any weapons in it. And so they had their security team drive behind.
But this time around, you didn't have security.
No, uh-uh. Uh-uh.
Did you feel safe without it?
Yes, I did. I felt, like I said, the tension had eased. Now, it was starting to pick back up a little bit. Either that or I was becoming more aware of the fact that there was still tension in the city. I did start seeing more guns, guns that were more visible. And as you've heard on some of the reports, that there has been some of the Somalis have fired on Marines and on installations. And there was some sense that would, attempts to do that would start picking back up. It is a tense city because you have an entire population of people that have no employment. They have nothing to do during the day. They're restless. They're agitated. They're really burned out by the situation. And it's even without the guns, you get the impression that it's people are very restless with it, and that this euphoria can't go on.
My guest is Anne Stingle, spokesperson for the American Red Cross. She just returned from Somalia. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Anne Stingle of the American Red Cross. You've told us that the presence of the military has created a safer atmosphere in Somalia. How much physical evidence of the military did you see? Did you run into troops wherever you went?
Yes. Well, of course, in Mogadishu, it was Mogadishu Airport was becoming like O'Hare with the amount of flights coming in, bringing in logistics and bringing in troops. Very, very different from the Gulf War, where you had a base location that had a power supply, it had water, there were certain human service systems already in place in Saudi Arabia, and you had a six-month time for them to build up. All of this had to happen from the ground up in Somalia. There was no water source, there was no latrines, there was no communication, there's no electricity, nothing. They had to bring in, as I left, they were quite proud of the fact that they now have two enclosed latrines in Mogadishu. And out of, with that many troops, you start to get a picture of how the military is having to deal with nothing and to build from nothing.
What were medical conditions like at the Red Cross centers that you visited? What are the medical issues now that the Red Cross workers are facing? And how do you hope that the military will be able to help?
Yeah. In terms of the medical condition, and especially as it relates to malnutrition, the emergency phase is not over. If those kitchens, and the Red Cross has 900 kitchens around Somalia, if those kitchens stopped, people would starve to death. In terms of, yes, things are getting better because the food is flowing to those kitchens, but those kitchens remain absolutely necessary, or we go back to square one.
What's it like around the holidays in Somalia now? Well, like at the Red Cross centers, do people do anything for, you know, in recognition of Christmas or Hanukkah or New Year's? Were there signs of that when you were around?
No, there wasn't. Not in Somalia itself. It was like stepping into another world. Christmas just didn't exist. I understand that. I had come home, of course, for Christmas and saw on television that the military singing Christmas carols, mm-hmm. and so forth. But in terms of the workers themselves, there was no real sign of Christmas. I know there were a couple of them that were trying to get in touch with friends who were with other delegations or in other locations because they said Christmas is a time for that. But there were no decorations, no real sign out of it. And it was kind of like, okay, it's better that we just not, you know, dwell on that too much. Let's just keep on going with the task at hand.
And this gets back to what you were saying before about how in any car with a Red Cross emblem, there can't be any guns.
Mm-hmm.
Why can't there be guns in a Red Cross vehicle? What is the philosophy of the Red Cross and weapons?
Well, if the Red Cross, because it works in areas of armed conflict, the International Committee of the Red Cross works only in areas of armed conflict, and it must be seen by all sides as neutral, as non-participatory in the conflict. If you have weapons with you, you must be using them for one side or the other. It carries too many implications. Generally, the ICRC is only armed with its copy of the Geneva Conventions, and that's the mandate under which it works. That's its only weapon. To have arms on a truck, it's too easy to be interpreted by one side or the other as indicating a preference or a political position. Now, in the case of Somalia, you had anarchy, and so the sides were much less, much more foggy and blurred in terms of sides. And then when so many were shot, it became necessary to have security with them and security protection. But this is unique and extremely unusual.
Did there used to be more international recognition and respect for the Red Cross than now? In other words, I mean, the warring parties, did they respect the neutrality of the Red Cross more than it's respected now? Are wars and feuds now just less ready to recognize the neutrality of anybody.
Well, Somalia, you have to remember, is unique in its in the element of anarchy. And the people, most of the people with the guns, many of the people with the guns, were teenagers that didn't know a Red Cross or a Red Crescent from anything else. Mm-hmm. It meant virtually nothing to them, and nothing was sacred to them. If they'll shoot up a feeding center, they'll shoot anything. So that you're dealing with a group of people that it's different than dealing with warring parties where you have, you know, sides and you have a military force.
Yeah,
yeah, mm-hmm. exactly, and rules to follow.
But, you know, it looks like anarchy might be the kind of war of the future, of the near future. Do you think that the Red Cross will need to change in any fundamental way in order to provide services in these in the kinds of wars that we're seeing now?
That's an excellent question. And it's one that has occurred to a lot of people. Are we seeing what can happen in the future? If you look at Bosnia and how that is seems to be fragmenting down to its lowest common denominator, as Somalia did. If you look at Liberia, are we looking at something that we're going to see more of? And yes, the Red Cross may have to adjust its role somewhat. I think how the international community treats anarchy is going to be something that needs to be addressed. It is something that will probably face everyone, as Somalia has.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Ann Stingel is a spokesperson for the American Red Cross. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Celebrations in the streets of Mogadishu, Somalia today, as the leaders of two warring factions get together for a peace rally and indeed a peace demonstration. We'll talk with a critic of the U.S. intervention who now says if you're going to do it, you have to go all the way through disarmament. A report on the UN-sponsored former Yugoslavia peace talks ending in Geneva, the presidents of Bosnia, Federal Yugoslavia, and Croatia getting together. Also, Maria Inahosa has a story from Crown Heights, New York. She talks with two families from the neighborhood, one Hasidic, one black. Each group in Crown Heights is suspicious of the other. Each group thinks the other group wants to take over the neighborhood.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Chances are you've never heard of Freddie Johnston, a 31-year-old rock musician from Kansas, now based in Hoboken, New Jersey. But rock critic Ken Tucker says Johnston's new second album, Can You Fly, is one of the left-field pleasures of the year.
Walking from the bus stop, couldn't wait to get off. I know I am the lucky one.
The key to Freddie Johnston's appeal is that, contrary to the lyrics of that song, he really doesn't consider himself a lucky one. A gangly guy with horn-rimmed glasses and a perpetually scratchy throat, Johnston is the latest to extend the long, honorable line of rock and roll nerds, driven to make terrific music primarily because they're nobody's idea of a rock star. When Johnston refers to himself as a skinny white singer with no more time, he could be talking about Jonathan Richman or Alex Chilton or Buddy Holly or Elvis Costello as much as he is himself.
Well, I sold the dirt to feed the band. Falling right through my hands. Yeah, I sold the map up to the sky. Falling down, always try high.
Johnston respects his elders to the extent that you can pick out his influences. At his best, he suggests Neil Young singing newly discovered Beatles melodies backed by the Beach Boys. But there's also something small-time about him. He's definitely got a self-pitying streak, and sometimes his sincerity can be so earnest he feels compelled to write a song about it, called Sincere. I don't expect Freddie Johnston to become a household name. Lacking the lung power of Michael Bolton or the complex moodiness of R.E.M., Johnston doesn't seem destined for pop stardom or even a long life as a college radio cult favorite. There's something fragile and wispy about many of his songs, but just when you think he's turning into a wimp, he bears down and comes through with the sort of tough-mindedness that only a dedicated rock and roll nerd can pull off.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Ken will be back with us on Wednesday with his top 10 list for 1992. By the way, Freddie Johnston is on Ken's list.
High off the roof we rise, flying to a hand up in the sky. All the bells in the city ring, I'm doing my California thing. It was a lie.
Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblitis, Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, and Bob Alls. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurak directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
I'm doing my
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Edward Allan has written a new novel that satirizes politically correct academic culture. The book climaxes at the convention of the Modern Language Association. Allan is attending this year's convention of the MLA. He'll take a break to talk with us on the next Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us.